CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com on a Tuesday morning. It is the 24th of November, in case you're watching the clock count down to the end of the year, which many people are doing. They're like, oh, as soon as 2020 is over. Only problem is, how do you know 2021 won't be hard as well?
Yeah.
You know, how do you know that 2021 isn't going to be challenging, to use a term our politicians use too often?
So, yeah.
It's worth thinking about.
Hey,
don't imagine all your problems are just going to dissolve away on New Year's Eve, and then New Year's Day you'll wake up and all of them will be gone.
Well, look, if 2021, knock on wood, does become worse than 2020, you might need some very strong language.
Oh, yeah?
To use.
Well, I found the most awesome list. They've actually published a complete list now of all the filthiest words in English. Okay, this is terrific stuff. It's really, really important. Every British swear word has been officially ranked in order of offensiveness. So this is great. This comes from The Independent. Every swear word has been listed in order of offensiveness. More than 200 people were interviewed across the UK on how offensive they found a vast array of rude and offensive words and insults. So,
what a survey to do.
They rated words either as mild, medium, strong, or strongest. Okay, so here we go. Mild. So you want some mild words to use? Here, you could use these words and you won't upset people too much. Ass, bloody, bugger, cow, crap, damn, ginger, git, god, goddamn, Jesus Christ, minger, and sod off. Any of those?
Cow is still a thing?
Yes. If you say someone, yeah, shut up, you old cow.
Okay.
So if you but it's considered mild, okay? So, shut up, you old cow. That would be mild. Okay, medium. Okay. Yeah, medium. Medium, asshole. Okay. Ass, remember, was under mild. Asshole, much ruder. My sister,
next level.
My sister calls me asshole. Isn't that nice?
No, it isn't.
No,
that's
what I thought. Balls, when you refer to balls. Bint, bitch, bollocks, bullshit, feck, munter, pissed, shit, son of a bitch, and tits. Those are medium. Son of a bitch.
Some of these are very uniquely British, then, because something like bint
or munter. Munter, yeah.
We don't really use.
Oh, well, I saw Sharon dead at pub the other day. She's a real munter, that Sharon. That's how you'd say it. And for bint, oh, she's a well dirty bint, that one. That's kind of where you'd use that. All right, strong. Here are the strong words. Now, these are getting quite heavy. So if you have children with you at the moment, you might want to turn this down. Okay. You
could, after arsehole, though.
You could never, have this conversation on radio, which always drove me crazy, because these words people use every day and we need to know, right? So here are some very strong ones. Bastard. Mm-hmm. Bastard is stronger than arsehole. Did you know that?
Oh. But, you know, it still carries a kick, hey?
Yep. Yeah. You bastard. What a bastard. Okay, then.
Dirty bastard.
Beaver. Mm. Beaver. Beef curtains. Bell end.
What?
Yes, beef curtains.
So descriptive. Someone says, you know, just you smelly beef curtains. You get the full picture of what they're saying. They aren't mincing their words.
I think Sia's going to find a place to use that this coming week. You'll walk up to someone and go, what are you doing, beef curtains? All right, so clunge. Clunge is a great word. We never use that much in South Africa, but... yeah. Tracy's been hanging around down in a very dodgy part of town. I think she's making her clunge available.
That's what she's doing.
All right. Then cock, dick, dickhead, fanny, flaps, gash, knob, minge, prick, punani, pussy, snatch, and twat. Those are all considered very strong. But there are still three words that are considered the strongest of all. And if you use these three words, then you really mean it. And they are very offensive. They're considered the top three roughest words in the English language. They are, do you want to guess?
Well, I have the list.
Oh, okay, so you know already. So they are the C word, the F word, and motherfucker.
Rightfully so.
And I only used the C word and F word used means of describing them because I thought, you know, we don't need to say them because we have strong language on this show often. And I just thought it would be necessary for people to apply a little bit of self-censorship here where possible. But other words that were rated strong were cocksucker, dildo, jizz, ho, nonce, prick, teaser, rapey, skank, slag, slut, wanker, whore. So those are considered quite strong words as well. Anyway, isn't that good to know?
Still stands, hey?
I think that's really good stuff to know. So now you can say you learned something this morning. Isn't that helpful?
You're nothing but a low-life whore.
Exactly. It's still a good word. And you've got to spell it W-H-O-R-E. You can't just go H-O. You know, that's a whole different one. Ho has its own list of reasons to be offensive, but whore, W-H-O-R-E, that's old school. You use that in very specific circumstances. Okay, Nikki says, and rightly so, after all that foul and dirty language where I need to cleanse myself, Nikki says this morning, the best thing you can do right now, today, in the middle of all of this craziness of 2020, is to start helping others. Spread some love and kindness. I think that's a very good instinct that she has there, and I'm absolutely thrilled that there are people who are thinking about doing the right thing and helping other people during a time like this. We should all be able to do something for someone, even if it's someone you don't know. So apparently Sia tells me that there was a guy who was charged with assault, which is a very dangerous crime. He was charged with assault after breathing forcefully on protesters. You know, some people say words are violence, which they are not. And in this case, just breathing on someone is a form of assault. How is this possible? Where did this happen? Well, Sia has the details. I think I'm going to get very annoyed by this story, but go ahead.
No, well, once you find some brief context, you'll understand that it's just Americans being Americans, because this was a protest happening near the Trump National Golf Club in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. So why there was even a protest of people thinking it would make a difference to protest at a Trump golf club, I don't know. But anyway, there were these two women who were protesting there over the weekend.
Yeah.
And this man comes up who was who was taunting them as a Trump supporter. So ended up, you know, they had a war of words for a while, and he could tell that, okay, he was really stoking the fire here. So then he started saying, you know, coronavirus, and then he like breathed all over them, and these women
they lost their shit,
beside themselves. They just could not stand it at all. So this happened over the weekend, and then on Sunday,
yeah,
the county sheriff's office confirmed that his name is Raymond Deskins. He's 61 years old and was charged with misdemeanor level assault. And so there's a video that has now been shared on social media that shows a woman, we can't see her in the video, asking this Raymond guy to move away from her. And then they get into the war of words. At the same time, another woman pointed out that Raymond isn't wearing a mask. And that's how this whole thing starts. But assault, just for...
Yeah, assault. Breathing? You see, I think, again, this is like people have taken everything to the nth degree in the year 2020. And there is no such thing as a moderate or mediocre response. Everything has to be outrageous. Everything has to be pushed to the max. So here's a guy who's clearly a Trump supporter, he's hanging around. He's dressed in the Trump T-shirt, but he's got a tube, you know, that kids would use to float in the pool? And and the front of the tube has got Donald Trump with two thumbs raised up into the air and like a blow-up version of Donald Trump's head. So the guy's obviously a massive Trump fan and possibly a little bit childish as well. Anyway, he goes up to these women and he breathes. But he's not breathing in their faces. He's kind of going, you know, like, he kind of just blows in their direction.
He's
like,
taunting them.
Yeah, there you go. You've got coronavirus. And this woman is screaming at the top of her lungs. She's insane because every reaction, you know, needs an equal and much more, I'm sorry, not equal, a much bigger and much more outrageous reaction. And this is what humanity's come to in 2020. It's just absolute madness.
But on both sides of this incident, it's ridiculous in my perspective, regardless, because when did it happen? Weeks ago, where Trump was even on the golf course playing golf. And weeks later, you're still there and you are protesting. You are wasting your weekend.
You're wasting.
Shouting about.
Right. You're wasting your weekend. I don't care enough about any politics to actually go to a rally. I know you don't either. There are people who will. They'll spend their whole weekend protesting someone who doesn't even know they exist. What would you do that for?
You know,
what's that about?
Rally's one thing. Sure, if you, I don't know, you guys have all marching for a cause and you're going to sign some document and leave it at some office. This is a golf club. You woke up and said, you know, it's Saturday, I'm going there. I'm going to be in my little tube floaty thing. Or this woman and her friends also are going there. I just think it's silly on both sides. But okay, he now has an assault charge.
Unbelievable.
So stupid.
Very, very stupid. There is a story about Kim Jong-un's nephew that we need to pay some attention to this morning. Kim Jong-un has a nephew called Kim Han Sol, which almost sounds like Han Solo from Star Wars. But Kim Han Sol has reportedly been taken in by the CIA after his father was murdered. What a family. What a family.
So Kim Han Sol is 25 years old, and it is now being reported that he is under protective custody by the CIA. And so it seems like he could be a bit of a whistleblower to speak about what's really happening in his family. Days after his father was murdered. Now, his father was murdered with a nerve agent as well. All of these details are just so sketchy. But we don't know where Kim Han Sol is, but definitely he can't go back to his uncle. That's for sure. So he sought the help of the CIA, and he is reportedly aiming to bring down his uncle's evil North Korean dictatorship. And this is after his father was assassinated a couple of years ago in 2017 at a crowded airport. So really has no care at all for his uncle. And, you know, do you think he actually could do enough damage to bring down Kim Jong-un at this point?
I just think this family is so screwed up. Where's his sister who supposedly has taken over the empire? Because we still haven't seen him for a little while, and people are starting to suspect that maybe something happened to Kim Jong-un. But that sister of his who looks like pure incarnate evil. I mean, there's no other way to put it. She just looks like the coldest, meanest person that has ever walked the earth. And there's some stiff competition in that front. I don't know what's going on in that place. What a mess.
Yeah, there are reports that the CIA have taken him to the Netherlands. If we have listeners in the Netherlands,
really?
Please let us know if you've spotted some things there. Yeah. But of course, the CIA refused to comment on any official word on this.
Sure. Okay.
What are they meant to say? Like, hey, of course, sure, it happened. We've taken him and we are working on a great master plan now.
No, I just don't want her to take over. I'm very worried. She'll definitely nuke people. She doesn't look like the kind of person who would take any prisoners. Everyone goes down. Everyone dies. Everyone.
And even your own family.
Yeah, I know. Oh, but that's exactly why I say she's cold. You know, it's one thing to be a vicious and cruel person to complete strangers, but it's another thing entirely to be like that with your own family. And that seems to be the way of the Kim family. They don't seem to be the nicest people, you know, even to each other. So it's very strange.
Well, this is further what makes tomorrow's conversation fascinating with Noor bin Laden, to get a glimpse into that reality of, you know, some wretched ways that are being done in your family and how you actually deal with it. You know, here I am complaining about Aunt Tabitha every now and then, doesn't hold a candle to the light of the Kim Jong-un family.
Sure. This is funny. Listen to Janet. Janet says, oh my goodness, I have to tell you guys a story. My then boyfriend was sending a text to a friend one night. He put the phone down and he came to bed. 5 minutes later, my dad phoned me. He said he just wanted to let me know that he thinks my boyfriend sent a text to the wrong person. Of course, I had to tell him and he jumped up to read the message. It started with,
oh no.
Hey, motherfucker. 15 years in, the guy and I are married. And yes, we often bring up the incident. It's kind of like when Sia shat his pants in our family. Yeah, I speak to my friends like that because we have horrible names for each other. We say terrible things to each other. And if someone else read those messages by mistake, they'd think that we were like mortal enemies. Like we really couldn't stand each other. So you've got to be very careful about what you put into a text message because it is there forever. Yeah, hey, Ketua, how are you? Ketua, can you hear us? I don't know if she can hear us here, but we can watch her drinking her water.
Oh, no.
Why don't we just carry on watching? Let's just watch Ketua, and she doesn't know that we're talking about her.
Oh, no.
She drinks her water. Now, let's see what she does next. This is very exciting. This is like an episode of Big Brother.
No, I don't want her to pick her nose or something. No, yes, I don't
come
want
on,
that.
Come on, do something. You know how you sometimes watch people and on a webcam and they don't know what they're doing, like on a Zoom call or whatever?
Please let me call her.
Yeah, give her a call. Sia, sort this out. Sia's going to try and sort this out so that we can get her on the line properly. I'm gonna throw her out of the call this morning. All right, lots of other messages that are coming in. Elaine says, I took my teenager to the Zuma Must Fall protests at the union buildings to show the value of protest. Well, good for you, Elaine. I don't think protests are any use at all. I've always thought that anytime a mob of people get together, I'm very uncomfortable. Even if they have a good reason to get together. Even if they're nice people. You know, and I'm just very nervous. I don't like a mob. A mob makes me extremely uncomfortable because in an instant, a mob can make a bad decision and things can go horribly, horribly wrong. Something about being an individual that I value far more than being part of a mob. Tracy says, Afterlife 2 had the best blooper. The pub scene in the second series was hysterical. And then she sent us a link, but I'm not going to put that up now. You guys, going through that list of the most offensive words, I just love that. That's from Yurak. You just read the list that presenters are never allowed to say. That is correct. Carl says, Gareth, I bought myself a restaurant table and chairs. They have magical powers. Now my family and friends can visit with no risk of getting COVID. Listen, you talk about this COVID thing. There are people who are not going to be able to see their family for Christmas or for Thanksgiving. I think Thanksgiving is Thursday in America. But Christmas is just, you know, a month away. And there are going to be people who are not allowed to join their family for Christmas. Now, I'd like to see the politician who's going to tell me I can't see my family at Christmas. I want to know who that person is because I'll give them a mouthful. And that's where violence will ensue. Trust me. I'm going to take my Christmas away from me. So forget about it. And in places like Los Angeles and New York, and even in the UK, people are saying, well, you know, maybe you forego Christmas this year so that you don't get sick. What, from a disease that you have a 99% survival rate with? I think I'll take my chances with Christmas and Thanksgiving. Thank you very much. That is my Thanksgiving for the morning. Oh, Elaine says that she actually took three teenage children to the Zuma Must Fall protests. And she says there is a difference between protests and a rally. They were terrified after the Fees Must Fall protests, so I wanted to show them that it can be safe. Okay, fair enough. Nikita says Melbourne is still not allowed. You are still not allowed to travel in Melbourne to other states in Oz, and you have no active cases in the entire state. Yeah, that's the kind of nonsense that I'm talking about. And that's all being run by a particularly shitty politician in Melbourne. I think he's the governor of the state or whatever they call them in Australia. Kiatiwe, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Oh, fantastic. How are you? We were just watching you drink your water earlier, and I thought it was... It's great
with my
fun.
Hands shaking, right?
Yeah, we were just watching you. It was very bizarre. So let me introduce everybody to you quickly. Kiatiwe Zulu was first bitten by the history bug after being annoyed by the constant renaming of street names. And then she did a whole bunch of research, and I thought this is a really interesting way to look at things. And she discovered the stories behind the street names that had changed. She grew more and more to like history, and she decided to write a whole book about it. The book is called South African History Retold. And you know how much history excites me, so I thought we'd talk to someone this morning who's equally interested. Did I get that story right, or did I leave something out?
No, you didn't leave anything out at all. It's exactly as how it happened.
And now you've invented a board game.
Yes.
Tell me about this.
I think that was the most exciting part of the project because researching and writing the books was quite heavy. It's not the nicest of subjects to research about our apartheid past. Mm. But then I decided, you know what, if someone is going to feel as heavily about it as I did, maybe let me turn it into something a little bit more fun, even though the subject matter is not fun. But also people don't learn the same way. They don't take in information the same way. So I thought, let me turn the books into a questions and answers board game.
Yes.
Proudly South African history board game. And it took about 2.5 years to make.
Okay.
The testing of it was hectic, but the finished product, when it eventually came in, now is being played in by families all over the country, has been really exciting to see.
That's terrific. So you actually had an event, or you're still going to have an event, where you're going to invite people to come and play the board game, which should be lots of fun. I have friends who play these board games. They have like a night every week where they do this stuff. So we must get your board game to them because I think it sounds like fun. But tell me about some of the people that you've discovered stories about. Tell me about Pila Porsche Ndwandwe. And you know, we drive down these streets now that have been renamed. And a lot of the time it's just politicians trying to look like they're doing something. But there are amazing, amazing stories from South African history that many of us don't know a damn thing about. So tell me about some of the people you've heard stories of.
I'll start there. Pila Ndwandwe, she was studying dentistry in University of Natal, Westville. Mm-hmm. Wasn't Natal now. And she decided to go into the struggle. So most of the time, we always think that these people were... The struggle icons were sort of like doing uneducated people. No, they weren't. They were actually people with a very clear story of how they wanted to turn the country around. And they were very organized. Anyway, Pila studied dentistry and decided to go into the struggle. And unfortunately, she fell pregnant and left to go into the struggle and left her 2-month-old daughter behind, never to come back. She was killed and she was buried, and her body was never found. Eventually, her remains, when they were found, they were exhumed and brought back to South Africa. And the sadness of the story about Pila is that even though she had a child, that she could have easily stayed behind for and said, you know what, yeah, I'll hand over to other people who don't have this responsibility that I do have. She decided she's going to join anyway for the better future of that child. Unfortunately, she never got to see it. And unfortunately, I don't even know if her child was located or is known, but if she is, she now enjoys the freedom that her mother literally died for.
So did she die in Swaziland? Because I know she was
died in Swaziland.
Yeah, she was in Umkhonto weSizwe, right? And she worked with Muzi Ngwenya, who's another famous name. But you know, we drive up and down these streets, we don't often know who these people are, and it's kind of disappointing that South Africans South Africans pretend to be interested in our past. You know, you hear a lot of young people claiming that they know about the struggle and they believe that, you know, the biggest enemy in the world right now is racism, but they can't tell you a damn thing about the people who actually sacrificed their lives. It seems, first of all, it seems so ungrateful. But second of all, it seems to me like it's only being used when it's convenient. And if you studied the stories of these people, then I would maybe take you a bit more seriously when you talk about, you know, our past and what we've overcome and the kinds of challenges that South Africa has managed to make it through. Then I would take you more seriously. I'd consider you a real expert on certain subjects. Don't you agree?
I agree. And I always get bothered when people throw around the names just and don't tell you about the learnings that they are taking away from those people. So what if you know Rick Turner? So what if you know Nelson Mandela? So what are you going to do about now? What you know that they did? What are you going to follow? Do to follow in those footsteps? What are you going to do to make the change or carry on the change that they started? So when you start throwing around all these names, to me it's a bit deaf. If you're not telling me how they're going to influence and change the country.
So Kitiwe, can we buy your board game?
Yes, you can. All my products are on kitiwezulu.com.
Okay.
And you just basically place your order there and it gets delivered to your doorstep. Yeah.
So that's kitiwezulu.com, K-H-E-T-H-I-W-E, Zulu, Z-U-L-U.com. And I mean, I was reading about you, talk about studying people from history. So, I mean, you studied English, right, at university. And,
yes.
And you wanted to go into teaching and writing and communication, which obviously you've done with your book and all the rest of it. But you've also done a bit of marketing. And your specialities include script and speech writing, proofreading and editing, content and brand development. Have you been busy during lockdown besides developing games and writing your own books?
I used lockdown to write the second book, which is called South African History Retold, the history behind the women in the struggle.
Okay.
Because I realized that there weren't many, with the 156 names that I found for the street names, I think only 24 were women. Hmm. There were so many more women in the struggle than just the 24 that the streets have been named after when I wrote the book. Maybe there's been more renaming. So I used most of my lockdown time to finish my second book. Otherwise, it went very quiet in the writing side. I think when things go slow for people, the first things that they cut are marketing and content, sort of like related work. They cut it out of their budgets. So it was very quiet, but used the time to finish.
That's terrific. I'm so happy that you're doing this, because the more we can learn about history, the better we will be going forward. Mm. I always think that if you don't learn about the past, you are bound to make the same mistakes as your ancestors did. And we have lots of great lessons to learn in South Africa. So I think it's a terrific idea to have a board game so that, you know, kids can get involved. People can play it now during the holidays. And I think then when you drive down these streets, you might actually have something to think about rather than, another street name that the politicians have just thrown in here because they're trying to make it all about them, which often is the case, let's be fair. But sometimes it's really helpful to know who these people were.
It really has been. And it changes. It starts to change your entire thinking of, like I always used to say, I'm going to grow my child up to be, I have a 4-year-old. I'm going to grow up my child to be colorblind. Oh, well, we still have a color problem. So things like that become like rhetoric. It suddenly has changed for me a lot, because if she doesn't see color, how does she solve the color problem? So when you take learnings from history, And you apply them into today, you start to realize how important it is to know the history.
Tell me quickly, a lot of the people who've had streets named after them and who've had towns and airports and all kinds of other things named after them are ANC people. We know that there were other organizations that played a very significant role, the UDF, and the PAC. You know, people like Robert Sobukwe, who we know the name of, but really they're underrepresented because obviously the the majority party gets to make most of these decisions, especially when they're in charge of the municipalities. Were there people that surprised you from the outside of the ANC as part of the central part of the struggle that that you thought were very deserving of our attention?
Definitely, people like the Robert Sibukes. But what surprised me more, even besides the ANC and other the political parties' part, is especially because at that time there were all these xenophobic attacks that I was when I was writing the book. Is that people like Chief Albert Luthuli weren't even from the country, and that's the point I wanted to make as well about history. Is that when we were busy fighting each other as Africans and realized that our icons weren't even from originally from South Africa, it starts to change your entire mindset. But coming back to your question, yes, there were many other people. It's just that I can't think of them at the top of mind now because you get nervous.
Sure. No, don't worry. It's not a test.
There were plenty of people that I thought, gosh, I thought there was like an ANC person. I thought, because some of the names I knew, but didn't know exactly where they belonged. Very small in representation, you are right. Most of them are ANC people. But when you go through the book, there are some that are like, wow, I didn't know that they didn't even belong to the ANC.
Well, congrats on your book and on your board game. If you want to find out more, you can go to ketiwezulu.com and we'll post the link on cliffcentral.com for you to have a look. Ketiwe, well done and congratulations. And we hope to see you soon. And come in one day and we'll have a nice long conversation with you about South African history.
Thank you, Gareth. So it's nice to meet you. Thank you very much.
Good to see you. Ketiwe Zulu and the book, the board game and the book that she's written about South African history. Very, very cool. Don't you like that, Sia? She doesn't stop with a book. She gets a board game going. I like that a lot.
I like how it came to be as well. What a an organic thing.
Absolutely. We've got
time for more history.
Blind history, yeah. So this is a great episode. I loved it because I learned a whole bunch of things that I didn't know. Even while I was researching, Anthony Miederer, who co-hosts the show with me, brought some really interesting stories to light about Rasputin, who I knew a little bit about because I've read a number of books about the Romanovs. And Tsar Nicholas II and his wife Alexandra were the last Romanovs, along with their children. And I knew about Rasputin being in that court with them at the end of the Romanov dynasty and just before the Russian Revolution took place. But there were so many things about this guy that I didn't know, and I think that you probably won't find out until you listen to the episode. So if you're a big fan of history, like Ketiwe or like me, then this is really for you. And we're almost at the end of season 4 of Blind History, which is just unbelievable because it feels like yesterday that we started season 1. And this is a great episode. It's very funny too. I mean, Rasputin, they just couldn't kill him. They could not kill him. He just seemed, he's almost like he was some kind of superhuman who you just couldn't put it. A bullet didn't work. They wrapped him up in a carpet and threw him in a river. I mean, the guy was just... he survived everything. And there was something very, very interesting about this man. He lived not so long ago that we don't know what he actually looked like. We have photographs of him. Scary looking dude. But in his time, he was probably one of the most powerful people on earth. And you'd never have thought it because he was born a dirty Siberian peasant and ended up going to the most supposedly cultured court in the land. In all the world, the Romanov Tsar of Russia. It's just something else. Take a listen to this. This is the story of Grigory Rasputin, Blind History, Season 4, our latest episode.
He went out in the town in St. Petersburg and got drunk, which is not unusual, but he kept saying that he's big friends with the Tsarina. And then people came up and said, "Who the hell do you think you're Rasputin?" So he says, "I am Rasputin." "No, you're not." So he dropped his pants and out popped his massive penis. And he says, "I say no more."
"Rah, rah, Rasputin, lover of the Russian queen." That's how the Boney M song goes. But there's so much propaganda and there's so much mythology and there's so much
craziness in this man's life that it's actually, you have to spend an inordinate amount of time picking it apart to figure out what is true and what is made up. And what makes it even more incredible is that he lived only 110, 120 years ago. You know, this is not a long time ago. It's not like trying to pick apart the myth of Julius Caesar from the reality. This was a man who had all the characteristics of a Buddha or a Jesus or a Muhammad, but lived in recent history by comparison. His name was Grigori Rasputin, and he was born in 1869, died in 1916. He didn't just die. I mean, he died probably three or four times. And he was famous because he was a Russian mystic and a self-proclaimed holy man who most famously befriended the Romanov Emperor Nicholas II, the Tsar, the last Tsar of Russia, and gained huge influence in late Imperial Russia, especially with the Empress. And I know that this was suggested by Spike, who produces the show, and Spike also has a beard, and that may be the reason, but this was quite a scary looking guy. Every picture I've looked at with him in it, you can see why people would have been drawn to him or repulsed by him. Anthony Medder is my co-host. This is Blind History.
Yeah, this is another one I really loved. I really did.
I don't know if I did, huh?
Rasputin, I think it's very important for the listeners to just Google and look at a picture of him.
Yeah.
Because his eyes, I mean, even in that picture, you can see exactly, I mean, his eyes just burn right through you. And the fact that he, you know, he had something about him that he could have been a horse whisperer. You know, they talk about... you know, whatever. You know, they had a lot of horses and the peasants at that time. Yeah. But you know, he had something.
Well, look, he's by no means a good-looking guy, but he definitely had a mystical charm. He had a look which was arresting, to say the least. But he had almost like a balding patch in the middle. His hair was parted down the sides, this big beard, this very bony face, these deep-set eyes with these dark rings all around them. And in the propaganda posters that, you know, they were publishing around the time that he fell out of favor and he became the bad guy for Imperial Russians, they emphasized all of those features. So maybe history's been unkind to this man.
But he put that persona together. So there is a lot of history being unkind to him, 100% agreed. But he developed this persona. His hair was greasy. His beard long. He had rotten food in it. He smelled. It's amazing that he was so attractive to people.
Charles Manson is a very good comparison for him because he had the same sort of cult following. Mm. Women adored him.
Yeah.
How did it all start, though, for Rasputin? Because he didn't become, you said he created this character. So he obviously wasn't like this from the beginning.
So he grew up as a peasant in Siberia. So, I mean, that's of all the places
not
to grow
a great,
up.
Not a great place.
Not a great place.
Surprised he even made it to adulthood.
And his dad was a farmer. He was a wild kid. And I think if you progress in his young life, you know, he did a lot of mischievous things in the town and he drank from an early age. So
like any good Russian.
Yeah, like any good Russian. So, but he was special to such an extent that he had to leave. I think it's Potlaskrova.
What a great place. Potrovskoye.
That's exactly. And then he went to a monastery and something apparently had an epiphany and that sort of led him towards God and...
Almost like Constantine on the Damascene Road.
Correct. Just in a different environment at minus 40 degrees. and
with a lot of vodka in his system.
A lot of vodka. And from there, he displayed some sort of powers, mystic powers. Hmm. And people talk about it all the time, but we'll speak a little bit about it later and maybe what the explanations are for some of the events that happened with the Tsar, Nicholas II's family. But that's where he came from. And then he got married at a young age. So he really ticked the boxes in terms of what a peasant would do.
I mean, he was totally uneducated.
Yeah, exactly. He couldn't write even at the heart of his powers. And he would just scrawl a big G when he signed off a new minister. I mean, that was going to come to power.
I mean, what a thing. Yeah. These powers are just incredible that he ended up with at the end of his life. But let's just talk a little bit about this rise to prominence because, look, the imperial family of Russia were extremely powerful, extremely rich, but also extremely crap at their jobs, especially Nicholas II. History threw him a bunch of really great opportunities, and he squandered every single one. He had at hand the most powerful imperial inheritance that probably anyone in the 1900s ever would have succeeded to, the late 1800s as well. And he was the least talented, least ambitious, least intelligent person to ever inherit so much. And his wife wasn't much better either. She was also quite stupid.
Yeah, she was German. So that already created massive problems when the First World War started, so nobody trusted her. She had bouts of depression.
Oh.
As a couple, they were a disaster.
They were a disaster, but they did love each other.
Big time,
to pieces. Yeah. I mean, it was one of those very rare true love stories that you get in dynastic marriages. But neither of them was really good at anything. And they had this problem. And the reason we're telling you about the Romanovs now, and particularly Alexandra and Nicholas, is because they are the context into which Rasputin became an important figure of history. They had a son called Alexei. And Alexei had hemophilia, which was the inability of his blood to clot when he had an injury. It meant internally or externally, he would just keep bleeding if he bumped himself. I mean, it made him the most fragile little child in the world, and he was meant to be the next Tsar of Russia. So, almost as a symbol of how the Romanov dynasty had come to complete weakness and could not possibly survive, like a Fabergé egg, this child was just the most unlikely successor to the most rich and powerful and populous nation in that world. And this bizarre Rasputin character, who'd already developed a reputation going from village to village in Siberia, and barefoot with his big beard and his romantic eyes and his mystical abilities to heal, and to he came to knowledge in St. Petersburg. People started to speak about him, and he saw a way to make himself really important to this very strange couple that were in charge of Russia. And he said he could heal Alexei. And for better or for worse, whatever he was doing seems to have had such an impact on Alexei's health that Nicholas and Alexandra believed this man was from God. He was a miracle.
Correct. So firstly, I think that Queen Victoria pops in here. They have Queen Victoria to thank for hemophilia. Alexandra, that Tsarina,
yeah.
She was the granddaughter of Queen Victoria. So that's probably where that came from. But they kept it a secret. So nobody knew that Alexei had hemophilia. And Rasputin came into St. Petersburg. You know, he came on the back of relationships with bishops and important people in the church, and with his charisma. And in those early days, he kept it tidy. And what he did, they just said he's a man of God, very spiritual. He used to mumble. And then people said, "Well, this guy knows what he's talking about."
Almost like speaking in tongues.
Exactly, yeah. So they met Rasputin, and it wasn't immediately that the Tsar and Tsarina brought him in, but they had meetings, and it's well documented because they've got letters to show it. And 2 years later, as you mentioned, Alexei had hemophilia, and he had a bad episode. He went in a carriage and bouncing around, and he was in terrible pain. And they brought in Rasputin, and nobody knew the reason, or they speculate on the reason, but one of the big reasons is, at that time, aspirin was a fix-all tablet or drug. They used to use it for everything. But the challenge was that it thinned the blood. We know that now. They didn't know it then. So when the doctors would give aspirin to this poor kid, he would just get worse and worse.
Yeah.
So what he would say is, "Get all doctors out." And he would chase everybody out and say, "You must be on his own." And he would speak quietly to him and pray in that muffled tone. And the kid would just get calm. And he also calmed a very eccentric Alexandra as well, the mom. So
she was hysterical.
Yeah, she was hysterical. And that worked. He suddenly got better. So they thought, sure, maybe there's something to this guy. And the thing was that they couldn't care less about being the next Tsar. They just wanted him to survive.
Yeah. Well, this Rasputin was not a clean cut guy, though. He may have tried to persuade people that he was a man of God and he was religious, but this was actually cover for a very debaucherous, very lascivious life. You know, they found very serious accusations of rape and murder and terrible things that he did when people weren't looking. But he certainly wanted you to think that he was some kind of ascetic monk. He was none of those things. He was a dirty, debaucherous, dangerous guy.
Yeah, he was. But he often used to take his ladies back to his wife. He kept his wife. He supplied his wife with money, looked after his family. So he was a family man.
Matryona.
Yes. And he took them back, and he used to go to the baths with the ladies. And his wife at the time in Protoskoye, his hometown, was taking some people as guests for a walk, and they saw him basically fornicating with these ladies. And they said, wow, isn't that your husband? They said, no, don't worry about him. He's exorcising demons.
So either she was extremely gullible or very forgiving.
Yeah, she also said there's enough of him to go around.
Oh, okay.
So
but he had a hell of a sex drive, this dude.
He had a massive sex drive. And the thing was, he wouldn't discriminate. He would sleep with the highest society or with prostitutes. And he drank, and he really didn't have that under control. But when he went to go see the Tsar and he was drunk, he used to go and put his hand out of water and sort of get himself together before he would go and speak to them, because they couldn't see him like that.
Is it true that he had an affair with the Tsarina, or was that just malicious propaganda?
What I've read, Gareth, is that it's probably malicious propaganda. I think the big claim to fame for him with Alexandria is that it was for the son. Mm. And she needed him around because she was so worried about his son. And that led him to the time where he was basically number three in Russia, if you had to see the Tsar and the Tsarina. But he was actually number one, because both of them were quite weak individuals.
So he was effectively in charge of government too for correct. A long time. So he was the most powerful man to make the decisions and appointments and policy, you know, all of that kind of thing fell into his ambit.
Yeah, at the time that Nicholas decided to go to war, he felt the need to be on the front line for whatever reason. But instead of getting a competent up-and-coming minister, he got his wife to run the administration of Russia while he was on the front line. And who did she use?
Rasputin. But he also, I mean, he gets the blame for a lot of things because he was a convenient scapegoat. I mean, what happened at that time too was that the Russian Revolution was underway. You had communism on the rise. You know, Lenin and his cohort were starting to become important. And it was important for them at that stage to disenchant the people with the monarchy, and to show them that the monarchy was this old feudal, not particularly competent establishment that was also swayed by this crazy, dangerous mystic. And that all played into their hands very well.
Definitely. It's quite sad that all the people that worked so hard to bring about the revolution should have got a hell of a lot more accolade than Rasputin, because they say Rasputin was the reason why they brought down the house of the Romanovs. So, yeah, but you're 100% right. He was the perfect pawn for them to actually bring down the Tsar.
Now, one of the things that contributed to his reputation was the fact that it looked like it was impossible to kill Rasputin.
Yeah.
He had like 9 lives. So there were assassination attempts in 1914. There was a woman who tried to kill him by stabbing him in the stomach.
Correct.
That was in his hometown back in Siberia.
And apparently she lost her nose from syphilis from Rasputin. So she wanted to get her own back. Or it could have been an upset priest. There was just a whole lot of different reasons. But she went in and she tried to kill him. And it was such a small cut, but he made a big play of it. He nearly died.
But he survived, ultimately.
He survived, yes.
And then a group of nobles led by Prince Felix Yusupov tried to kill him. And they thought they had. I mean, just explain the scenario that took place in the palace. Because Rasputin, the fact that he managed to survive this is absolutely remarkable. Talk about 50 Cent taking like 9 bullets. This is even more incredible.
I mean, it reminds me of Peter Sellers in The Party, where he never wanted to die in the beginning with his bugle. Because, you know, he was never one to turn away excess food and drink. So they invited him to the palace. And being at a palace, he was always happy with that. So off he said, yes, I'm in. And he came, and they obviously plied him full of these cookies and food and alcohol laced with cyanide. And they were sitting there all waiting excitedly to for him to die, and he never died.
And they gave him tea and
he just got more and more drunk. So, but he never died. So they said, this is not working. They looked at each other. So he took the pistol from one of his colleagues, a gentleman.
Yusupov, yeah.
Yes, that's it. And then they shot him 3 times.
Right.
And there's one story that he ran into the courtyard. So there's various stories you read, but this particular one, he ran into the courtyard and then they shot him a few more times. So he fell down, and then they wrapped him in carpet. And then they cut a hole in the ice in the Neva River, dumped him in the river, and they found him 3 days later, and they proved that he actually drowned. He didn't die, so he was still alive when he was. So, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of embellishments.
There were also rumors that it wasn't really him that was found.
And he was still alive.
Absolutely. So yeah. that continued to be something. But they threw him off this bridge, wrapped in the carpet, into the ice. And he floated away under the ice. And that was the end of Rasputin, but his legend lives on.
And obviously. Grew and grew and grew.
Oh, yeah.
And you know that they were so disappointed, the assassins, that nothing changed. Nicholas didn't suddenly come back from the front line. Alexander didn't suddenly become less depressed. Nothing changed to improve the situation that they thought that the killing of Rasputin. So that maybe tells you that he maybe wasn't as influential as the stories now go in the demise of the Romanovs.
But the imperial family did attend his funeral, which is amazing.
Yeah, I didn't
amazing.
Know that. I wasn't yeah. aware, yeah.
So they met his family as well. The Tsar's family went and had tea with Rasputin's family at the funeral. And his body was later exhumed and burnt by a detachment of soldiers after the Tsar abdicated. And his grave was feared to become a rallying point for people who supported the old regime. So ironically, even though he was kind of postulated to have been this terrible influence on the imperial family, he became part of their legend as Russia transformed into a totally different communist system and utopia that Lenin had conceived of.
But so, the immigrants, you know that a lot of people left Russia at the time because of and actually it was scary times with the Russian Revolution. And they had all these stories about Rasputin that had spread around the world to such an extent. The movies were made and there's so much that was – so the supervillain, he's always been portrayed as the supervillain going forward.
But it was interesting. There were also all kinds of Russian high nobility, these old ladies who carried around lockets of with his hair in. Right to their graves, you know, and they say that the Tsarina eventually, one of the things she carried all the way to her death in Ekaterinburg was this lock of Rasputin's hair, which she thought would protect her.
Well, a lot of the ladies probably were missing getting their demons
exercised.
But his daughter, Maria.
Yes.
You know, he was very close to his children, which is, you know, it's such a difficult story, this, because, I mean, he loved his children and
somehow he found time to love his children.
Exactly. And and for the matter, his wife, you know, and he was quite derogatory sometimes. She was a plump, like a round lady that tended to the crops. But she went on to become a lion tamer.
The daughter. Yeah, she became a lion tamer in America.
In America. And she wrote a book and she did all of those type of things. You know, the famous, you know, the crazy monk's daughter.
Yeah.
I think that was where she got it from. But, you know, seriously, he, for whatever he did, and, you know, to get inside his head would have been incredible. Because if you think about when he was a peasant, was he massively ambitious? Did he create that persona because he was very smelly? He had food in his beard from months that smelled weird. He never washed his hair. He's shabbily dressed. So it's hard to say, you know, was this his strategy? Because he climbed all the way to he was number one in Russia.
Yeah, it's people absolutely used to, remarkable.
Yeah, and it's so hard to explain.
And he ended up in a Boney M song.
Yes, 100%.
He's done okay.
He's done okay.
For a stinky old monk.
Yeah.
Well, if that isn't someone that you haven't learned some new things about, then I don't know. Rasputin, who ended up being this incredibly powerful man in Russia, from being born in the Siberian hinterland. Let me tell you, anyone can rise to power and glory. There he is, Rasputin. Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Christ miniature, I sin. And that's really what that was.
You must accept my faults.
He used that excuse a number of times. And that's what he started out with his wife. In the beginning, he said, I'm a sinner. But what was important and what she realized was that he hated being in the positions where you would have to have sex with people. He hated every minute of it.
Yeah, of course.
But he had to test the limits to be able to...
His suffering was pleasure.
His suffering and to be able to improve and to be able to help the flock. So she believed it.
Had to keep going around having sex with all these disparate women.
Exactly.
Yeah. Terrible life. CliffCentral.com